Hello.
こんにちは。Welcome to the Glocal Podcast.
Brought to you by Kwansei Gakuin University.
東京丸の内キャンパス。
Our podcast is about people and events from around the world.
With your host, Tamago.
And Kangaku Taro.
Hello.
Hello, oh. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Hi, Taro.
Taro.
Taro. Tamago.
Tamago. How are you?
So you're at home or in your office? I can't tell from the background.
This is my my queen cave, I call it. It's my office. It's where
wow,
I work.
Cool. I like
it's
it.
Where I work out here. I work here, and I just chill here as well. So it's nice. It's at home, but it's nice. Like outside in the garden, separate. Like a man cave, a shed. Yeah.
A queen cave.
A queen cave. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. All right. So basically, we're here to listen to you and to listen about your efforts at sustainability and your activities in Kuwait, and maybe tell us a bit about your background as well and how you ended up back in Kuwait again.
So I started my environmental sustainability journey quite some time ago. I'm not going to say how long because it's going to give away my age.
Okay. And,
no, I started in 2001, 2002. I am my degree is in molecular biology, but when I moved back from college from England to Kuwait, I landed accidentally in a job working in a brand new aquarium. They were building a brand new aquarium in Kuwait. And I was just looking for a new job or whatever. And I thought, let me take the risk. And I loved everything about it. I learned how to dive. I was very close. We actually used to go out and collect everything. So most of the fish in the aquarium was actually caught in the sea in Kuwait. So.
Wow.
That that experience made me get really, really close to the natural environment. I've always loved the sea as a child, but through that specific job, my attachment just grew more and more. And through that time, we did some conservation work with the turtles specifically. So then I decided, I have a science background and I want to see some changes, and I decided to pursue environmental policy for my postgraduate degree because it's like it's the intersection between science and politics and policy. So that's what I did, and that sort of led me onto my journey. Did my postgraduate degree in the UK, and then worked a little bit in Copenhagen, and then ended up in the World Bank in Washington, D.C. And then I moved back in 2014. I moved back for like family reasons, really. But since I've been back, I've been working with the Kuwaiti government mostly on sustainability issues through the World Bank again, and as well with the United Nations Development Fund. And right now I'm working with the British government on a climate change outreach program in preparation for the climate conference in November. So they're doing, they have funding to kind of start the dialogue and take it up to a more serious level within Kuwait, from policymakers and society about the impacts of climate change and how that affects us as a oil-producing country.
Oil-producing countries, right?
Yeah.
And Kuwait is obviously one of the major oil producing countries in the world.
Yes. And 90% of our GDP is reliant on our oil exports. So we have a very, very unique situation here where, we're one of the countries that are at risk, not just from climate impacts, which will include the main one would be sea level rise. Everything is at sea level. And so the climate change impact for Kuwait will be mostly focused on the extreme heat waves, etc. Increased dust storms because the rainfall is decreasing in the entire region. And the dust usually comes from the Syrian Iraqi desert. You know, just from the just decreased rainfall over the last decade has caused an increase in dust storms in Kuwait and probably southern Iraq as well. And then as well, we have the issue of sea level rise, and most of the infrastructure in Kuwait is not resilient for the coming impacts. That's on the that's the impact as to us as a country. However, there's the other big red flag, which is the fact that we are an oil producer and there's a massive energy transition globally, with the target of most countries having a big percentage of their energy generated from renewable energy by 2050. Some, and even some companies have a goal of reaching net zero carbon emissions. That's for us, that's a huge risk, because you know the demand will probably drop, the prices will drop. I mean, even if there's a surge now, they will eventually drop. And the competition will increase, because so one of the strange impacts of climate change is the fact that most of Siberia will, the freezing landscape will start thawing, and that will open up more probably potential potential
oil fields.
For oil exploration, oil fields, exactly, oil exploration for Russia. So
right.
There'll probably be more oil in the market with less demand.
With less demand, right.
So yeah, so we as a country, I don't think we're the level of discourse and maturity is there yet amongst the society, amongst the average, you know, the typical Kuwaiti conversation never involves climate change. We're talking about immediate environmental issues, yeah.
So let's take a step back and situate Kuwait on the map for people who don't know exactly where it is off the top of their head. So you're on the Persian Gulf.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's where the sea level rise is threatening Kuwait.
The entire country is on the coast. So from the north to the south,
right,
will be impacted. And we have islands that are really, really at sea level. So most of these islands will be inundated.
Right. But the Kuwait is to which part of the, which border?
So the north
Iraq. I'm sorry. Yeah, Iraq is to the north.
Yeah. And Saudi Arabia.
And Saudi Arabia is to?
To the south and south southwest.
Okay. All
right. So it's halfway. So the north, most of our borders with Saudi, and then the northern part is with Iraq, and then across the sea is Iran. So not a very, not the most friendly neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so you have that, and then so the sandstorms are coming in from the northern side.
Yeah.
Mostly. Yeah. And then the rising sea levels are from, let's say, the eastern side of the country, southeastern side of the country. I don't have it in front of me right now.
Yeah, the rising sea level will be from the Indian Ocean or the Arabian Sea into the Persian Gulf. Once the world's oceans are expected to rise, and that will just seep into the smaller gulfs. So for us would be the Arabian Sea into the Persian Gulf. And the Arabian, Oman, which is overlooking the Arabian Sea, they started to experience more cyclones, et cetera, than normal. You know, it's already starting. So the changes are already starting.
Right. So the interesting thing is, like, a lot of countries will be hit, let's say, by one or two of these impacts, right? So in the Asian Pacific, south of Japan, let's say, you have a lot of these small islands that are at risk of sea level rise. Of course, very serious risk of sea level rise. But they're not oil producing nations, so they're not at risk of a reduction in national income. They don't have sandstorms, but you have, you know, all three. And you're saying that most Kuwaitis are not necessarily cognizant of it, or don't really care that much, or what is it exactly?
No, I think it's the former. They're just not cognizant of it, you know. The climate change discourse has not really gone mainstream in Kuwait.
Okay.
So as a country, so Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the U.S. until recently, like with this was with the Trump administration, they've always had a very hostile posture towards the climate change negotiations because of their oil-producing countries. However, that's changing. You know, the reality is that since the Paris Agreement, you know, a lot more countries are committing, and we just cannot be in that bubble again. So I don't think. In general, the environmental consciousness and awareness in Kuwait is not that high. We're still 20 years behind, I would say, the rest of the world. However, it's starting. It's starting with the youth mostly. You know, they're not disconnected from what's happening with the same age group worldwide. Also, you know, people can see on a daily basis. The littering, we have some of the waste problem and some of the air pollution and so on. So people are beginning to become conscious of their environment. It hasn't yet shifted to a proper discussion about climate change. So this is what we're trying to do, myself and my partner with our initiative to start to raise awareness about this issue.
Okay, tell us more about this initiative, because that's more about you as a private citizen, correct?
Yes. So we started now a year and a half ago. I have this environmental background, and my partner, she has a retail marketing and finance background. And it just, the idea came really, and my sister traveled to Istanbul and she came back with this item here. I'll just show you. I don't know if it's on video. This is a clutch made from ocean plastic.
Right.
And I thought this is great. And just to, when I started to just look at the innovation with recycling and upcycling, the idea came to me, and I told my friend, why don't we start this initiative? It's a fun way of raising awareness about environmental issues without being preachy and making people feel guilty, by showing them how the cool stuff, right, the fun stuff of being sustainable. So the focus started with, why don't we focus on sustainable fashion? The Kuwaiti society is very fashion conscious. They care about clothes and whatever. So and there's a wasteful also behavior. You know, fast fashion, like the cheap $2, $3 t-shirt. You know, we're not different from the rest of the world. People wear it for a few times and then throw it away. So it started really with that. Let's raise awareness about sustainable consumption, the idea and why we're doing it, whether it's current environmental issues or future environmental issues. Because if you're looking at sustainable consumption, you're looking at the pollution that's generated from producing this item, but also the carbon footprint of producing this bag or shoe or whatever, or clothes or so on. And so many companies around the world have changed their production pattern, what's called life cycle analysis, where they've looked at where they can reduce waste, where they can reduce pollution, and where they can reduce their carbon footprint. So that was the idea. We started this initiative, we started promoting the idea of like reducing your plastic use, think about your fashion consumption, buy better quality clothes, buy less and buy better. That's the goal. And we were going to sort of, and the other thing we wanted to do is also promote this burgeoning scene in Kuwait. There's a lot of small green businesses, individual efforts,
nice,
popping up. So we're like, you know, we can be a platform to promote these businesses at the same time as raise awareness of the issues.
How it works, the fashion upload, I mean, in Kuwait?
So Okay. I mean, it's a big struggle, you know. So there are now, like, there's a couple of local brands that are sustainable and ethically sourced. It's usually from India. Local brands who, you know, work with small communities, etc. Fabric producers, textile producers. So the business owners in Kuwait just source these fabrics and they design the clothes here. That's on the what the sustainable brands are here, local brands. However, in terms of the upcycling of plastics, this is very complicated. I mean, there's nothing in Kuwait that does that. It's a very expensive process. A lot of it is done in Europe, I think now in the UAE. So what they do is they take the ocean plastic, so let's say bottles, fishing gear, and so on. There's one example I can give you, a good example. So the sweatshirt I'm wearing, it's from a Spanish brand, and it says, because there's no planet B. I'll just show you in case, you know. Okay. And so this brand is all about sustainability. So what they do is that they go out and they pay the fishermen. They pay the fishermen to collect the plastic. So when the big fishing ships go out, the trawlers, whatever, they also ask them to collect the plastic. And then this company buys the plastic and then they process it. So they convert it into yarn, which is then made into textiles. Yeah. So you can make puffer jackets and so on from plastic. You can make athletic wear, anything with spandex and so on. And you can make shoes and all sorts upcycling plastic. So that's really how it works. Yeah.
Okay. That's a nice system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And tell us more about your efforts in Kuwait. So what kind of impact do you think you've had in the last year and a half? And what's your favorite approach in terms of reaching out to your audiences?
So, in Kuwait, so we were planning to have a 2-day event, like an environment open day, where we showcase the small green businesses, have workshops. We were going to invite sustainable fashion experts to speak, highlight all of, but then, you know, the pandemic hit. So like everywhere else, we've been on hold. So what we decided to do during lockdown, came up with an idea. So because of the lockdowns globally, a lot of shops have unsold stock. Fashion is seasonal. Right. So some of, you know, and this is the mentality that we want to change, obviously, but. Even now, even with things kind of going back to somewhat normal in Kuwait, there's still not a lot. There's no parties, weddings, etc. So there's a lot of old stock piling up So one of my really good friends has a boutique, and she has unsold stock. So I came up with the idea, you know, to instead of, you know, just start to upcycle some of this old stock, turn it into new clothes or new household items or new accessories. So we launched a competition in September, inviting designers, tailors, etc., to apply and think of the concept of what we call zero waste design. So they can pick which item they want and they can decide what they want to do with it, whether they want to turn it into new clothing items or accessories or home accessories, and use the old stock that we collected from this boutique. We have rules for the competition. They can use this much And then the criteria would be how little waste they generated, whether they use the entire fabric, they upcycle the entire fabric or item or not. So we measure on that. But then we also look at design, etc. So we had we've had 10 applicants, 10 people that were selected, and we split them into two groups. Five are working with a established artist slash designer in Kuwait she's mentoring them. And the other five are with also an architect slash designer, whatever, who's also mentoring them. So they're two teams and with their mentors and, as you know, because they need guidance. They have ideas, but probably they don't know how to cut properly or they don't know how to stitch or whatever. So we were very lucky to get very, very talented people. I think we've got the potential to discover a future budding sustainable designer in Kuwait. We're not done yet. So hopefully next month we'll select the winner.
Yeah. So can you tell me, do you approach the younger generation, like students or junior high or high school students? And then so how?
Yeah. So before the lockdown, before they went online, the schools are mostly online now in Kuwait. We would visit the schools, give lectures, showcase some of these items and so on that we purchased, highlight some of the ways they can, let's say, compost, etc., like anything they could do at home. And since then, honestly, it's just been Zoom talks mostly with young students. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we part of that event we were going to have is to have like a play area with sustainable practices for children. But like the rest of the world, everything's gone on hold now. Yeah.
So what about your discussions with the government around sustainability?
It's a mixed bag. on climate change, the Ministry of Planning understands the issue. The Environment Agency, not so much. It's kind of strange.
Well, what goes on? Like when you talk to the environmental agency, what do they say? What's their position?
Well, you know, they do what needs to be done. They comply with the reporting. They comply. They attend the meetings. They always have a position. But have they mainstreamed climate change within the agency itself? Not so much. Some large infrastructure projects will have a climate risk assessment, but it's not formalized in the legislation yet. Right. It's case by case.
Is it like voluntary then?
It's basically, it'll be in the terms of reference that the Environment Agency puts out, depending on the size of the project. So it's at the discretion of the head of the Environmental Impact Assessment Department, really, in the agency. It's not something that's formalized. So the Environment Agency, for us to have successful climate action, they need to start pushing this agenda and ensuring that climate change and the environment is part of the discussion in the ministerial council and the development planning, etc. And that's really the role of the Environment Agency. However, I feel that the main champion is with it's called Supreme Council of Planning, which is the equivalent of the Ministry of Planning. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunately in Kuwait, it's maybe it's the same in a lot of the developing world. It's about it's not so much maybe the institution, but who's leading it and their direction and what they believe. So But we're this is part of what we're trying to do, which is start the dialogue and push for this idea of mainstreaming climate change and environmental sustainability within the framework of the entire government.
Whoa, so
there's a lot, right?
Yeah, there are lots, and so because so, there are lots, and then because the we're not familiar about the desert. So the beginning you explain about the sandstorm. But we cannot imagine what the sandstorm, how it impact to their, you know, life or their daily life. Because if we're talking about a flood, in Japan we have a lot of river. So if you say flood, earthquake, oh, it's gonna big disaster. But if you say sandstorm. Sandstorm. So we don't have any idea. Yeah. So please let us know how difficult to survive in a sandstorm or the how impact to the.
Okay. Okay. So sandstorms are awful. They're not like an earthquake. Obviously, it's not like what Japan has to go through. I mean, you know, but. So sometimes the sandstorms are so bad that you cannot see 100 meters, not sorry, 100, like 10 meters away. They're very bad if you have any respiratory condition. So if you have asthma, it's magnified. But even if you don't have asthma, even if you're, it's just very difficult to breathe. And then when you step out, you know, everything is covered in sand. And then it obviously damages the infrastructure a lot because a lot of the sand keeps piling up on the roads and the airports, etc. So it just becomes difficult to move around and drive. But it's really sometimes, honestly, the entire country looks orange. You know, just a few years ago, you know. When the Fukushima happened in Japan, the disaster, in Kuwait, we had black sandstorm. And people thought it was coming from Japan. Obviously, it wasn't, okay? But it happened like a month after, or not, a few weeks after. But, you know, like, no, that's not... I mean, it was just a fluke, a strange storm that came from... the east, not the west, and I think it carried with it some of the volcanic ashes or something, and the country was just covered in black. The average sandstorm here is really, really risky for people with respiratory diseases, and it feels like something. Like I said, the visibility is very difficult, and you know, you get sand in your nose and your eyes and. So normally you don't leave the house really much, or you stay indoors. You know, if it's a severe sandstorm, you stay indoors. If it's the average, no, you function, but you find people wearing masks or something just to breathe better. Yeah.
So can you prepare for the sandstorm, or it happen suddenly like earthquake?
Yeah, I mean you know that there's a storm coming just from like, you can predict it the day before, 2 days before because of the wind action. So the meteorology department here is good that way. I mean, they do warn people that there's a storm coming. You know, the severity sometimes is unknown, you know. Like I said, like a few years ago, really, it was just, you can't see outside the window. And everything looked orange, just like it was like we were on Mars or something. You can, but normal. So one of the solutions for this is to stabilize the soil, stabilize the desert. And I think the we could say that also there's a decreased rainfall because of, and that's kind of encouraging the increased sandstorms. But also, even if it's a desert, it's there's some vegetation in the desert. There's trees and there's desert plants. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's just a bad land management, overgrazing from, you know, sheep and camel and so on, as well as some unsustainable like uses. It's caused the vegetation to disappear.
So stabilizing the desert would mean revegetate, planting more of these. Okay, so
yeah.
Is that being
or even
go ahead.
Even leave it, even if you just leave it, if you just protect it, if you just leave it to rehabilitate naturally. The desert will bloom again. I mean, with a few protected areas here in Kuwait, honestly, you see the complete difference, especially maybe the summer months, it's too hot. But during the year, you can see the vegetation and the ecosystem recover. So if you let the...
So if you let it be, it'll regrow. But basically what you're saying is that there are protected areas, but just not enough?
Yes.
Okay.
So there are protected areas in the desert and in the north, the wetland, which is between Kuwait and Iraq. There's an island called Bobyan. So that's the north part of the island is protected. Kuwait is famous internationally for conservationists as a bird watching spot, because there's migratory birds that migrate from Asia, like around maybe the Caucasus, all the way down to Africa, and so they pass through that wetland from November to February, March.
Wow!
So you get really lovely, lovely bird variety.
Wow, that's encourage us to, you know, doing sustainability work, activities. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah, because I thought the desert is just desert, and then so it won't, you know, so recover all the, it's all sun and then so never changed, I thought, but that's truly encouraged me or the us a lot. Yeah.
So the desert, when you see in the movies, the big sand dunes, whatever, I think that's what most people think of the desert. But, you know, 2 years ago, I went to Mongolia. I went to the Gobi Desert. That's not a desert to me. That's a beautiful, absolutely gorgeous greenery, you know, but the desert is defined as where there's really minimal rainfall. So the desert in Kuwait is flat, but it has natural vegetation. But if you go to the desert in Saudi Arabia or in the Emirates or Oman, that's really stunning, you know, mountains and so on. The native plants, they're desert plants, but they're also, you know, good trees, maybe not as lush as some of the trees in Japan, but they're beautiful still. I think they're really beautiful. Yeah.
I want to see.
Kuwait is, you're welcome. Let's get rid of Corona and have you all visit.
Oh, by the way, Samia, just a side note, you were in Japan actually before. You visited Japan.
Really?
4 years ago. Yeah, 4 years ago. This month, actually. Yeah, 4 years ago. I went, my two good friends competed in the Tokyo Marathon.
Oh.
I didn't compete, I just, I clapped for them. I waited at the finish line. And then we spent 2 weeks. We went to Kyoto, Osaka, around Mount Fuji, Hokkaido, skiing in Nisiko.
Niseko, right?
We went skiing there, and I loved every minute of it. I loved everything about Japan.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
You guys have the best food in the world. I honestly.
Okay, back to Kuwait, because like, yeah, seriously, it's like so many things that you mentioned. So like, what is your priority project right now, and how would you measure success for it?
In terms of sustainability. As sustainable living, as the initiative that are on.
Let's say both, or let's say either for you as your private initiative, or for your efforts with the government. So on a macro scale.
Okay, for us as a private initiative, I think we're still, like I said, we're still trying to figure out how to navigate the current situation. So. We're focused now mostly on raising awareness, just getting the conversation going. With the government, so I was involved, so as I mentioned, there's I would like Kuwait to be better prepared for the climate conference in November. So we're trying to push for that. But I also, in December, we completed with the World Bank Solid Waste Management Action Plan. So I would like to see some of the recommendations come to fruition. We're very, very high waste generators as individuals in Kuwait.
Okay. So for the listeners who don't necessarily have a background in policy, what does a solid waste action plan look like? What does it mean? If you can break it down in sort of in a couple of sentences.
It's improving the... The sorting and disposal of waste in Kuwait, from the services to the landfill management to the regulations. And so when you're trying to say improve the system, you also want to reduce the amount of waste generated as well. So it's a holistic approach to tackling waste management in Kuwait. I think because in Japan and in I think South Korea as well, in Japan is famous for incineration. They use waste, a lot of waste to energy. They generate energy from waste. This is something that we're trying to apply here. And I think there's an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, if I'm not mistaken, with the Japanese government on how to transfer this technology to Kuwait. In South Korea, they have one of the strictest sort of waste collection services in the world. They don't actually collect a lot of waste, so they force the household to reduce their waste. So they force the household to recycle, they force the household to compost and so on. So I remember when I was living in the States, when I didn't understand, being coming from Kuwait where the garbage is collected every day, I didn't understand in Washington, D.C., why weren't they collecting? And, you know, in my, sort of Kuwaiti hat, I'm like, God damn, you know, these, the local services, you know, they're just stingy, the taxes are going to waste, etc. But that's not the thing, that's not the approach. The approach is you force people to reduce the amount of waste they produce if it's not actually collected. So we're trying to change the mindset in Kuwait because, so Arab culture is very hospitable. So when somebody, when you invite people over, if you're inviting 10 people, it's normal to have a spread of food for 30 or 40. That's all Arab countries.
By the way, a side note for Japanese listeners is that a lot of these invitations happen at home. You don't invite people necessarily to a restaurant. You invite them to your home, which on average is much larger than a Japanese home. Yes. And usually you would have a large sitting area, relatively large sitting area for guests, right?
Yeah, exactly. A large sitting area, and you always have a lot of food. So there is we have a big food waste issue. And the thing is with food, it's organic waste, right? So when it ends up in a landfill, it decomposes and it generates gas, methane gas. And methane gas is a greenhouse gas. It contributes to warming the planet. So we're trying to, like I said, change the mindset, which is, you know, you can invite 10 people and make food for 10 people rather than...
Or 12 people.
or 12, yeah. But not 30.
right.
You know, so... And then also we generate a lot of plastic waste in Kuwait. It's a very hot country, so people drink a lot of water bottles, even though the drinking water, the tap water in Kuwait is clean. Because it's not, we don't have a river or a lake or anything, so people assume because it's coming from a desalination plant, that it's not clean. It's actually cleaner than anything because it went through a very strong chemical process to get to the house. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, we're trying to raise this consciousness that you can just put a filter at home to make sure, you know, that you're if you don't trust your tank or your pipes, put a filter at home and try to reduce your plastic waste because it's everywhere. I mean, it's really bad.
So all of that is part of your action plan that you've presented to the government? Okay.
Yes.
And so the idea... Go ahead.
So the idea is to start segregating the waste at home and then improve the collection service. So you have, the cleaning companies know how to collect recyclables and to manage them properly, and then the actual waste will go to a more of a sanitary landfill rather than now, so they're like more like open dump sites really. And then with the recyclables, we have an informal sector now for recyclables, but formalize it, regulate it better, and create, let's say, opportunities for small and medium enterprises to start like processing recyclables and selling them to the local market or the regional markets within the Gulf, so to the neighboring countries and so on.
Sounds amazing. So what does it mean when you say that you want to work with the Kuwaiti government to prepare them for the November climate conference?
Okay, so in Paris in 2015, the historic agreement, each country put forward their plan to reduce their emissions. It's a document called Nationally Determined Contributions, where they have an action plan mentioning how they're going to reduce their emissions, whether it's through emission reduction, like switching more to renewables, there's something called nature-based solutions, which is, planting more trees or using the carbon sinks, they call them, which is like mangroves, etc. Or depends on, each country determined what project. So we had renewable energy generation, waste to energy incineration, and then adaptation and improving the green cover as ways to reduce our emissions. So the next conference was supposed to happen last November, but it was postponed. So every 5 years, countries have to come back with stronger pledges. So to come back with report on their nationally determined contributions that they've decided that they planned back in 2015, report and then pledge some more. So, like I said, the pandemic pushed everything back, and that was supposed to be in November. So, the first 5 years were more voluntary, and it's still voluntary, but now from 2020 to 2030, the countries have to demonstrate more concrete action. So for Kuwait, Some of the projects that we had and the national tournament contributions in 2015 did not have not been approved yet, like waste to energy and so on. Yeah, wow. Yeah, we're still in the
I thought you were going to say they were not achieved, but you're saying they were not even approved.
Well, it's the initial plan, the initial project was there was some financial issues with it. This is why now they're switching, because the MOU with Japan to learn more about Japanese technology, because there was a proposed project, but it was too expensive, too big, etc. There were some issues with the actual project planning. But it was in the NDCs, in the National Tournament Contribution. So it's not for 2021. We cannot have it in the new NDCs as an achievement. So so we have to update the NDCs and put something more concrete. So this is what we're trying to start negotiations with the government. What do you want as NDCs? If you can, if these large, very expensive energy, financially difficult projects cannot come to, cannot will not see the light of day in the next 2 years. Let's think of more viable options, like nature-based solutions, for example, which is improving water resource management, increasing the green cover, having more protected areas, and so on. Just so that we don't, sort of go to the conference without being prepared for anything. And another approach that the Gulf countries, the oil producing countries, are seriously considering something called carbon capture and storage, which is it's very, very new technology. It's been piloted in Canada, maybe in some other few other countries, but it hasn't been scaled up yet. But it's the most viable option for oil producing countries, because I don't know much about the technology, but the main premise is that you try to capture some of the carbon that's emitted and store it underground, or utilize it again in specific certain industries. It's all very complicated. I mean, I still don't have a good grasp of it, but I think it's one of the this is the approach that Saudi Arabia is going to present in the next conference, and I think Kuwait will probably follow suit.
So yeah. Do you collaborate with the other countries, I mean the neighbors? I know it's difficult to collaborate, but you collaborate.
So the six countries, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, UAE, Oman, and Saudi Arabia, we're all in a regional organization called the Gulf Cooperation Council. We're all these countries, very similar economy, very similar demographic, very similar socioeconomic circumstances, very, very similar history, and even, we all share, a lot of us share very similar ancestry as well. The six countries cooperate on a lot of things. Like we travel freely, we work freely between the six countries. There has been some issues in the last 3-4 years. There was some political problems between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but it's now water under the bridge. The political problems are being resolved, but the economics, on the environment, whatever, there's a lot of cooperation. Yes. So there's for fisheries, there's some regional cooperation on fish, managing fish stocks. There's future possible collaboration on managing the air pollution, and looking at sources and trying to reduce the sources from different countries. So yeah, there is. It's not like the European Union or something, but it's okay.
Okay, so Samia, I'm gonna leave it to you. Anything you would like to share with a Japanese audience, or anything you'd like to share in general? Or third option, anything you'd like the audience to know about Kuwait?
Okay, so let's see. So anything I want to share, people to know about Kuwait? Just on a lighter note. So I mentioned six countries. So each country has a characteristic. So in Kuwait, amongst the six countries, we're known to be the funniest and the ones that love music and dancing and whatever more than any of our neighbors. And we get invited to weddings just to create an atmosphere.
There's some really good Kuwaiti music, actually. Anything to a Japanese audience?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, it's the same message for everybody around the world, really. It's cool to be sustainable, I guess. Support your local green businesses. Think about the waste that you're generating. I know in Japan, obviously, it's not like, let's say, you know, the United States or something as per capita. But waste generation or energy consumption, it's not the same. But I would say, I'm sure, you know, I'm 100% sure there's a lot of very, very innovative and small businesses that are, you know, doing good. And I would just encourage you all to support your local business as much as you can, the sustainable businesses.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, Samia.
Thank you for joining
us. Thank you for inviting me. This is fantastic.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Glocal with your host, Tamago
and Kangaku Taro. See you next time.
Bye-bye.